It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Obama's strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL, the terrorist group which calls itself the Islamic State. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In a speech to the American public last Wednesday, President Barack Obama announced the United States will lead what he says will be a broad coalition to take out ISIL extremists that have been rampaging throughout the Levant and holding vast swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq.
But this is not our fight alone. American power can make a decisive difference, but we cannot do for Iraqis what they must do for themselves. Nor can we take the place of Arab partners in securing their region. And that's why I've insisted that additional U.S. action depended upon Iraqis forming an inclusive government, which they have now done in recent days.
The president spelled out a four-part plan, continuing the airstrikes that already have shown success in pushing back the militants in Iraq. He said the objective is clear: degrade and ultimately destroy the militants through a comprehensive, sustained counterterrorism strategy.
First, we will conduct a systematic campaign of airstrikes against these terrorists. Working with the Iraqi government, we will expand our efforts beyond protecting our own people and humanitarian missions, so that we're hitting ISIL targets as Iraqi forces go on offense.
And for the first time, President Obama said he will not hesitate to take action against ISIL across the border in Syria as well as Iraq. He also promised to ramp up U.S. military assistance to the Syrian opposition, reaffirming that the United States cannot and will not rely on an Assad regime that terrorizes its own people and which has even cynically, if not overtly, collaborated with ISIL forces against the moderate opposition.
Second, we will increase our support to forces fighting these terrorists on the ground. In June, I deployed several hundred American service members to Iraq to assess how we can best support Iraqi security forces. Now that those teams have completed their work and Iraq has formed a government, we will send an additional 475 service members to Iraq.
President Obama reiterated that these American forces will not have a combat mission. He promised that the American people will not get dragged into another ground war in Iraq, but that the forces were needed to support Iraqi and Kurdish forces with training, intelligence, and equipment.
Third, we will continue to draw on our substantial counterterrorism capabilities to prevent ISIL attacks. Working with our partners, we will redouble our efforts to cut off its funding, improve our intelligence, strengthen our defenses, counter its warped ideology, and stem the flow of foreign fighters into and out of the Middle East.
And lastly, the president promised continued humanitarian assistance to the innocent civilians who have been displaced by ISIL.
This includes Sunni and Shia Muslims, who are at grave risk, as well as tens of thousands of Christians and other religious minorities. We cannot allow these communities to be driven from their ancient homelands. So this is our strategy. And in each of these four parts of our strategy, America will be joined by a broad coalition of partners.
Well, for more on the specifics of the strategy, the specific roles for partners such as Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, and the UAE, and others, and possible impediments to its implementation, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Paul Piller is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University here in Washington. Professor Piller is also a retired officer in the U.S. Army Reserve and has a distinguished 28-year-old career within the U.S. intelligence community. And Faisal Itani, he's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based here in Washington. I'm delighted to welcome both gentlemen back here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Paul Piller, let me begin with you. I wanted to give a broad airing of President's strategy. Do you think he outlined a workable strategy? There are so many intertwining and moving parts such that it could eventually, as he says, degrade and destroy ISIL?
Well, the president really didn't have a whole lot of latitude to come up with something much different from what we heard. Clearly, the public and political mood is such that he had to come up with something presented very formally, as he did in a speech to the nation, that takes very seriously what has now come to be seen through conventional wisdom as a serious threat of this one group. At the same time, he has to face the strong American public resistance to getting involved in a big additional ground war in the Middle East. So he's been threading a needle here, and if you consider those sorts of, in some ways, contradictory pressures on him, he couldn't have done something a whole lot different from what we heard last night.
But in your view, what he outlined, is it feasible? Do you think it's an effective strategy for the threat at hand?
Well, let's take quite literally the objectives of degrading and destroying. Degrading, sure. There's some that's already been done already with the airstrikes in Iraq to degrade capabilities in the field of this particular group. But when we start using a word like destroy, and even the word defeat, which we hear in some other contexts, that really raises the question of what is feasible. And I would ask us now, you know, on the anniversary of 9/11, to think back 13 years, how many Americans back then, at the onset of what the previous administration termed a war on terror, where there was this enormous upsurge in national commitment to do something about and to destroy the group al-Qaeda, would have thought that 13 years ago, we would not only be dealing with an offshoot group, but even al-Qaeda Central, the group that did 9/11, hasn't been destroyed. It has been seriously degraded, but not destroyed.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, for your reaction to the president's speech. Obviously, a so-called reluctant warrior. I think President Obama would be astonished if he had thought that at this time in his tenure that he would be making such a speech. But this is the reality. And some say he has been too cautious.
I didn't think anything presented in the speech was particularly novel, given the sort of build-up to the speech itself. I mean, a number of things that were presented, to be honest, you know, the rejection of working with Assad, the notation that we've increased, not we will, but we have increased support for the moderate opposition, and once again, the repeated request to Congress for allowing them to increase support to the rebellion. These are all presumably things that are already in place. The new element is this expansion of the counterterrorism strategy to Syrian territory, to go after ISIS in Syria. I agree with Paul, I think degrading is feasible. I think destroying without some sort of ground effort against ISIS, not necessarily a U.S. one, but some agency, that's just not possible. And I would add that our targeting of ISIS and our including Syria into the issue is somehow, according to the speech, disaggregated from the question of where we stand vis-a-vis Assad, where we would hit them and who would benefit, what happens if on the balance tactically it helps Assad, and what happens if it helps the opposition. I don't think these things, they may well have been thought through, but they weren't addressed in that speech.
All right. Well, one thing that's critical, of course, back to you, Paul Pillar, is dependence on a so-called broad coalition, an alliance of actors from the Middle East and Europe. In your view, you know, who's on board and who isn't?
Well, there's a fairly broad spectrum of governments in the region that have their own reasons to see ISIS as a threat and to oppose it, even without the persuasive powers of our president and secretary of state. In terms of what they would deliver is something else. You've got hesitations, particularly when you talk about the Saudis and the other Gulf Arab countries. But from the U.S. standpoint, I think the most important thing is not so much what some of these countries can do on the ground, but it's more the symbolic and political value of having a large coalition, including Sunni-dominated and run governments like that of Saudi Arabia, on the side of going after ISIS. And that helps us not appear to be simply, once more, a Western country and the leader of the West conducting operations in which Muslims get killed. And it also minimizes, but does not eliminate entirely, the hazard of being seen to take sides in an intra-Muslim sectarian conflict.
Turning to you, Faisal Itani, what do you expect from any of these actors?
This is a really complicated and troubled effort. There is a convergence of interest between these parties in going after ISIS, fair enough. But there's a lot of disconnect in terms of other interests and how it's to be done and what these coalition partners respectively would expect from the United States and what their own capabilities are. Turkey, as you probably heard, has been quite reticent about throwing their full weight behind this effort, at least in public. ISIS poses its own risk to them. They hold some of their citizens. And I feel like they don't really see an interest in going out on a limb here vis-a-vis ISIS unless they know that something is going to be done to address their interests in northern Syria. Iraq is obviously the government is in theory the partner here, and it is a relatively effective one against ISIS. But of course, geopolitically, the partner in Iraq is de facto Iran. You know, for better or worse, some people may disagree about whether that's a good idea or not. But that flies directly in the face of this urge to sort of rally the Sunni powers and local Sunnis against ISIS, because, you know, that's exactly what they don't want to see. And the Gulf countries are, they've already been pretty deeply involved in the Syria issue to begin with, less so in Iraq, but perhaps that will increase now. But, the truth of the matter is they're not very capable. Their intervention and their handling of the Syria situation has actually made it worse on the balance. So I'm not sure that delegating that problem, especially on-the-ground element of the problem, is probably the wisest strategy against ISIS.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Paul Piller. He's a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University here in Washington, and Faisali Tani. He's resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council, a policy group based here in Washington. And we're discussing the new strategy to combat ISIL, the group that calls itself the Islamic State. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And here's a shout-out to loyal listener Nelson Azuma from Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with comments and feedback to encounter@voanews.com. And please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielleVOA. And please follow me on Twitter. Well, back to you, Paul Piller, to continue this discussion, particularly on the political side, for example, the new Iraqi government. Do you see a more inclusive government, one that will try to accommodate its Sunni population? Do you see that making a difference?
Oh, it's critical in terms of what happens politically in Baghdad. There has been progress. To put it quite bluntly, it was progress to see Mr. Maliki out of office. There are still, even in the current new government, some T's to be crossed and I's to be dotted with regard to the defense ministry and the interior ministry. So there's continued bargaining going on. That said, I think there's going to still be a lot of wait-and-see attitudes among many Iraqi Sunni Arab who were so disillusioned with the course of events in Baghdad that they're going to have a new course not just promised to them but demonstrated before their allegiances are going to appreciably change.
Turning to you, Faisali Tani, if that's the case, is there enough time? I mean, what is your assessment of the new Iraqi government and its ability to incorporate Sunnis within the government? Because obviously a lot of these Sunnis have gone toward or been so disenchanted with the Shia-led government that they have, by default, gone over to support ISIL. So do you see a tide turning?
I'd agree with Paul. I think conceptually this is the right idea. I mean, at the end of the day, the only solution to this ISIS problem is to bring the Iraqi Sunnis back into the political mainstream. I think where you might have a serious problem with the Sunni community is once the Iraqi government, if indeed it does, arrives at a point where it has to break ISIS in these sort of heavily populated urban areas that they hold in Anbar and Nineveh provinces, then, that's a difficult slog, and it's a dirty war. They will have to have, the Sunnis pretty confidently bought into the process. Otherwise, it will backlash.
Carol, if I can just add, sure. Pertinent both to the immediate issue of the politics in Baghdad, but also the topic we were discussing a moment ago about the larger coalition, we should note that the Iranians, who previously were speculated to perhaps, hold on tight to the idea of Maliki remaining in office, he was seen as sort of their guy, clearly came around to the idea that he indeed was more part of the problem than part of the solution. I think that's a good sign. It's a sign of realism on the part of the Iranians.
Well, speaking of Iran, what about vis-a-vis Syria then? Would they be less likely to hold on to Assad? Because right now we're looking at, obviously, it's a very complex situation. Even if the United States launches airstrikes on ISIL in Syria, that could conceivably benefit Assad. But at the same time, the United States does not want Assad to be benefited. And they're now late in coming, saying they're going to also try to bolster the moderate opposition. Presumably they'll be trained in Saudi Arabia. So what about the Iranian role in Syria?
Not just, tactically and militarily, but politically, the two situations, Iraq and Syria, are very different. And I quite agree with Faisal's earlier points that the president's speech left some very important questions about Syria unaddressed. I mean, they no doubt have been addressed in the private councils of the administration, but we didn't hear about them in the speech. And these are rather basic questions of, you know, what the end game is and what politically we hope to achieve. The president did reaffirm the idea. He didn't literally say Assad must go, but he basically used words that, did not backtrack from the previously established anti-Assad position. I would just note also that the president did leave himself a bit of wiggle room when he talked about he wouldn't hesitate to use military force in Syria. That wasn't quite the same thing as saying, well, we've already done airstrikes in Iraq, and next week we're going to add to that in Syria. He didn't say that. So one thing we're going to have to watch very carefully in terms of the military action over the weeks ahead is just whether indeed we're going to see something in Syria.
Turning to you, Faisal Al-Thani, what do you think we're likely to see in Syria, and what kind of talks, if any, are going on, back-channel talks, to come to some kind of a political solution for that distraught country?
The Iranian position on Assad is a bit different than Maliki. There is has been an established Iraqi state, broad, big, large institutions, quite well embedded in the country, and that go far beyond Maliki and his immediate friends. The Syrian regime is structured in a different way. It's a much tighter circle. It's been hollowed out and weakened enormously over the past 3 years. And its general foreign policy orientation, including support for Hezbollah, the alignment with Iran, probably wouldn't survive a real meaningful change in leadership in Syria. Because that change in leadership would either be a Sunni-dominated one, or it would be an Alawite leadership capable of securing the country and reconciling with the Sunnis. Or an Alawite element, if you will, if not quite leadership. And that's not going to happen, and also look out for Iran's foreign policy interests in Syria. So I don't really see a clear alternative for them at the moment. I mean, in theory, you could have a situation where there is an opposition reconciliation with elements of the regime. Not necessarily don't have blood on their hands, because that's probably a bit much to ask.
Right.
But aren't Assad and people who decide to remain loyal to him. But that required two things. Most importantly, it would require that the regime or large portions of it come to the conclusion that they can't win the war. And it would also require that there be an opposition on the other side capable of securing their territory, speaking on behalf of the Syrians that they allegedly control, or the territory they allegedly control, that still doesn't exist. Now, that could exist if there is, again, theory could exist, if there is a robust U.S.-led effort to create such an opposition, however difficult that is.
One more question to both of you, or at least to you, Paul Pillar, with regard to Saudi Arabia and Iran, because it will be difficult enough to get all the Sunni powers, you know, on the same page, so to speak, or collaborating in an effective way to make this strategy work. But at the end of the day, you have Saudi Arabia on the one hand, of course, Iran, a Persian power, a Shia power. They have, both of them, an interest in seeing ISIL destroyed. But at the same time, they have different interests, obviously, in both Iraq and Syria. How important is their convergence on this, and can we get there?
You know, one of the tendencies we have as Americans, Carol, is to always divide the world up in a Manichaean kind of way. In the Cold War, it was, you know, the communists versus the free world, and now when we look at the Middle East, it's either, you know, the Islamists versus the secularists, or the good guys versus the bad guys, or whatever. I think a lot of other people, and I would give policymakers in Riyadh and Tehran credit for this, tend to see things in a little more careful, issue-specific way. And they don't just say, well, this person's an ally, so we'll work with them, and this person's an adversary, and we won't. I think, again, here, there's on your specific question, there's a major difference between Iraq and Syria as the two theaters here. Syria, for the reasons that Faisal enumerated, it would be difficult for these two Persian Gulf powers to find a whole lot of common cause. But I don't see why in Western Iraq you can't, in effect, have tacit common cause, where the main contribution I would expect from the likes of the Saudis would be using whatever influence they may have with Sunni tribal elements, the ones that did, you know, come over to our side, if you will, back during the surge in 2007, and persuade them that their best interests are to break with ISIL and to work with the Shiites in Baghdad. Well, at the same time, the Iranians, according to reports we've read in the press just over the last few days, have been doing some real support on the ground in Western Iraq. Well, these are two different things, but they would complement each other. And I don't see any reason why Riyadh and Tehran wouldn't or couldn't continue to do those sorts of things despite their other differences.
So despite their differences, Tehran and Riyadh, Faisal Al-Thani, do you see some common ground, at least in Iraq?
Yes, absolutely right. I think they have there is scope for cooperation. it's probably already happening. It's a sort of de facto temporary alliance. They have a common enemy. The Saudis are well placed to have leverage over some of the Sunni actors in the West and Northwest. The Iranians, of course, have been deeply embedded in Iraq's political and security structure for years and have never left, in fact. They are going to be the people who are going to be playing this role in the Shia side on the ground.
All right. Well, speaking of leverage, and just a couple of questions before we close. Back to you, Paul Piller. You know, the United States has lost a certain amount of leverage around the world, particularly in the Middle East. Do you think it has the leverage that it needs to really crack heads, or rather get all these disparate actors to work together on this strategy?
Well, ultimately, with not just this problem, but countless other issues around the world, it's never been a matter of cracking heads. It's been a matter of deftly and skillfully working with the self-interest of other parties in a way in which we can make something greater than the sum of the parts. I mean, it's no different in that regard than, say, dealing with the Ukraine crisis, where it's not a matter of cracking heads either with our European allies or with Mr. Putin, but of leveraging the interests that each of those parties have to try to come up with a workable solution.
So, Fazil Ithani, do you think that the United States has the kind of leverage to help all the different parties, you know, see that their interests converge? The concern I have is that particularly some of the Middle Eastern actors, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Turkey, have been disappointed in the United States previously, whether vis-a-vis Syria or the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So, again, will they be able to see that their interests here perhaps trump, you know, whether or not they trust the United States in this case?
Yeah, no, I think in Iraq, if indeed, as appears to be the case, the United States is actually committed to this outcome and strategy, yeah, I think it could happen. I mean, they don't have to trust them, the United States. They just have to see, as he said, that it's in their interest to work together with them. They don't really have many choices in Iraq. They had somewhat more leeway when there was a sort of broad Sunni insurgency with many elements in it. But this has, you know, become an ISIS-dominated insurgency, and that, by definition, shrinks the room for maneuver. In Syria, no, I don't think the U.S. has that leverage. That the problem in Syria is, you know, essentially it doesn't have any partners. The Assad regime is not a partner. The opposition is difficult to speak of as one party to begin with. And the ones that do exist, you know, in a coherent manner, particularly in the south and the northwest, well, we don't have much leverage over them because we don't seem particularly interested in the trajectory of that conflict. So, you know, leverage is there if the commitment is there, and in Iraq it is. In Syria, I don't see it.
Well, lastly, back to you, Paul Piller. Obama did refer to the warped ideology of the Islamic State, also known as ISIL. What about combating the ideology? He really just didn't say how we would do that, but you can, you know, strike and kill as many leaders or combatants as you want, but the ideology is there unless root problems are addressed, whether it's economic or otherwise. What are your thoughts with regard to addressing the factors that motivate foreign fighters, particularly from the West, to join this kind of group?
Well, there's nothing new about this or specific to ISIS. I mean, Carol, I was working on counterterrorism in the U.S. government back in the 1990s, you know, pre-9/11, and we were worrying about these things. Some of the players we've been talking about, we're really one player in particular, and that's Saudi Arabia, has been ahead of the curve in so-called de-radicalization programs. Now, what the Saudis have done are very expensive efforts involving small numbers of people to keep them from being recidivist terrorists that require a lot of community involvement and so on. We can't duplicate that. But ultimately, it gets far beyond counterterrorism itself to a lot of the issues having to do with U.S. foreign policy and how Americans are perceived and U.S. policy is perceived, which relates to some of these other issues you touched on earlier, the Palestinian conflict, you know, the use of military force by the Americans elsewhere, that are important to a lot of people, that are the source of grievances, that sometimes, and for some people, become the source of hatred, that for some small portion of them translates into the sort of terrorism we're most concerned about, which is anti-U.S. terrorism. And I would just add in that connection, this is one additional complication about going after ISIS that the president did not mention, and that is the revenge factor. Look what motivated so much of the concern here in the United States, the killings of the two captured American journalists, and the group explicitly describe that and try to rationalize it in terms of retaliation for the strikes that they had already suffered from us. So that is a question we have to continue to keep in mind. The more we go after this group militarily, how much does that mean in terms of additional efforts at retaliation through terrorist attacks or killing hostages?
Indeed, very complex problem. I hope we can do a show on this. But back to you, and for the last word, Faisal Itani, with regard to combating the ideology. Of course, it's going to be difficult. The United States is in a catch-22. It's going to ramp up its efforts militarily in terms of intelligence, fighting hopefully the source of financing. But at the same time, it has to be done. What about the other factors that motivate fighters, whether from the Middle East or from the West, that feel, you know, this pull toward ISIL?
Look, ISIL is a bit different than some of the things we've wrestled with before, because it's taking root and has most appeal in geographies whose politics are defined by the sectarian problem between the Sunni and the Shia. Ultimately, the root of this problem isn't so much U.S. policy. It is a perception that the Sunni Arabs in this part of the world are being mistreated and repressed by minority governments or Shia governments. That is the problem. Those things can only be addressed by A, addressing the repression issue, but also making sure that the spearhead of the sort of violent, aggressive reaction against ISIS is Sunni. Otherwise, we get stuck in the same circle over and over again. And to ISIS, you know, the proximate enemy are the Arab states and Iran. These are the real enemy, the real Murtadin, the worst in the United States. So again, this is like a sort of coalition of evil for them. And it's all wrapped up in one another, the Zionists, the Americans, the Shia, and the Shia are the worst, and the Sunnis who don't agree with them are the worst. It's nothing you can disaggregate from their local conflicts, particularly in the Levant, and particularly where you have these minorities living alongside each other.
All right. Well, certainly we'll be following this and addressing the issue in the weeks to come. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Paul Piller, Professor in Security Studies at Georgetown University, and Faisal Itani, Resident Fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Thanks, gentlemen, so much for coming in and sharing your insights.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.